Okie doke.
Okay, let's start with, you know, how you remember Warren, but tell us how long ago that was.
Well, I left Warren in 1922 when I was 21 years old. So a lot of things have taken place since then that I don't know about because I went down to Massachusetts. But I remember the town from the time I was going to school, started school and that like, of all the businesses that were in the town of Warren. And it was a busy little lumber town. They had a lot of mills. I don't know what anybody told you, but how many mills there were there, and they were run by water power. And should I tell you the start of the first one?
Well, is there too much noise out there, Miles?
From?
Any rubbing, or that's okay?
I wasn't close enough attention, I'm sorry. From the hands on?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Was it all right?
We're hearing, we're just picking up a little bit of this sound.
So oh.
If you could try to...
Tie my hands.
Yeah, right. Put them in your pocket or something. Great, thank you.
We don't have to go into too many details, but, you know, if you just say that it was a lumber town and, you know, tell a little bit about the stores and the mills and that kind of thing.
Well, I think it's interesting that Jim Pierce, on the south end of the town, going towards Granville, had a clothespin factory where he sawed out, made little clothespins. And when they got a two-horse load of them, they used to take them clear to Montpelier with horses, and while the springs was put into them. And then there was another mill down below it, a small mill, where they sawed out little squares run by Azra Parsons. And then when you get down to Warren Village, where you go to Lincoln Gap, there was a mill there owned by Palmer and Wakefield, a novelty mill, and they made out catdog handles and rounds and that like. And then there was the creamery. And what I'm getting at, all these places was operated by water. And then down in the heart of town, Pliny Parker was a man that owned a lot of the mills and that like. Had a clapboard mill where they got out big stocks of logs in the winter, and then spring come, they had a mill dam, had it dammed up and had a pond in the spring when he sawed the logs into clapboards. And then the other mill down lower in the village was a lumber mill, of course owned by him, and that mill had a steam engine in it, so in the summer when the water got low, they could still operate. And then across the road from that lumber mill was a grist mill. Part of the farmers back in those days raised a lot of grain for their stock. They would take it in and have it ground. And then a little way down towards Wakefield, short distance, was another mill that made butter tub and butter boxes. They used to ship a lot of their butter in wooden tubs. But all most of that power was used was done by water. And today they had no mills or anything there. And another thing was, except the clothespins, all the other stuff was hauled over Rockford Mountain with horses to the railroad. And that was some job. But the railroad was there, and then, of course, Warren had the stage route. Mail used to come over Rockford Mountain twice a day, morning and afternoon. And the farmer used to go over there and buy a lot of the grain and stuff. And, of course, in the wintertime, those roads were kept open with the rollers, snow rollers. But I thought it was very interesting to think of the number of mills and all the product was hauled over the mountain to the railroad station in Roxbury.
Excuse me. How did Warren contrast with Waitsfield?
Well, Waitsfield was a little, the settlement was about the same size back then, the stores. See, Warren John Spaulding had a general store, and a big store for the size of the town, and you could buy most everything in there. And George Bragg had a grocery store and that like. this side of it, and then Warner Moore started in with a harness shop, barber shop, ended up so he had a general store along with the harness shop and everything else. And then there was the, of course, they had the post office, and there were two blacksmith shops. Harlow Abels had probably shod horses and things like that, and Frank Blake had the other blacksmith shop. And then later, Harlow Abels put his shop into repairing the old Ford cars when they become around Model Ts. And they used to, well, they used to make all their, most of their shoes, like my father did. He had a blacksmith shop, and of course he was a veterinarian and done corrective shoeing. He used to come to Randolph and buy shoe steel rods, and he made his own shoes and done all that himself.
What do you see? Explain to me the difference now between Warren then and Warren now.
Well, Warren now is he's got the only business Warren has got is the ski business, Sugar Bush. All those little farms and that like up in West Hill are in ski territory. And there was a lot of dairy farms, small dairy farms, well, big ones. And my father had five farms put into one. So when he sold it to my brother, he had 450 acres, more or less. And today, there's only one farm in the town of Warren shipping milk, and that's up to Dupree's, where they have the gliders. And that's the only one that's shipping milk. Before that, the town of Warren had a lot of farms, quite good-sized farms. Pearl Daniels up to East Warren had the largest farm, and at one time he was milking 125 Jersey cows. They did it all by hand, and he had usually about six hired men the year round. And it was all done by hand. And back then, 125 cows was a big farm. And now the barn's gone and everything else up there, except there's a horse stable, and that isn't running anymore.
Tell me about your father and, you know, the veterinary business, how he trained horses, and also a little bit about how you boys had to work on the farm and you know, how you weren't paid a dime.
Well, it's just as soon as any of us got big enough to do something, why, Dad had things for us to do. And so I was the youngest of four boys, and so I had to start in feeding hens and chickens. And from that, I kept getting a little bigger, and I had to do more. And at one time, before Dad built his big barn, he built a horse barn in 1898 for horses, because he raised a lot of horses, and he was a trainer and breeder. But in 1913, he built a big cow barn, 44 by 100. And added on to that barn there. But until we got that new barn, we did chores in, four different barns that we had to do chores in. And one of them was below towards Warren Village, a quarter of a mile, and that was my job when I got to be, I was 9, 10, 11, 12 years old. Go down there, and we had to let the heifers, kept heifers down there. And then the water didn't run down in the winter, so they used to go up to the home farm, get their water, and then clean out their stable, and then they'd come back. But if it was storming, wind blowing, they wouldn't. I had to walk up a quarter of a mile and drive them back. And that old barn was so cold that the manure would be froze, so sometimes you had to use a pick to clean the stable. That was the way the old stables were. And then around the other side of the hill was a farm where they kept just horses. One of the brothers did that. And then we went to the Dan Cardle place, which was over half a mile cross lots to get to it walking, was another farm where they did had cattle. None didn't have any horses or but cattle. And then the home place with two barns there. So we had chores to do in a lot of places. So everybody had a little something to do. And
it must have been, the other thing is, you worked with lanterns, that must have been.
Oh yes, we didn't last, I don't remember just what year it was, but about, I would say probably 2 years or so before I left home, Dad bought a Delco plant and had it down in the basement of the barn, the room fixed off and kept it. And that, of course, Delco was charged the batteries, and then we had 32 volt light. And boy, we thought we had something then, because we could snap a button and have a light. Before that, we had kerosene lanterns and carried them around and hung them up in different places to see, to get around to do your chores. And that was quite an improvement to have, not have to carry lanterns, because at times that the wind blew up on Fuller Hill, and a few times we light up the lantern to see it, to go down and do chores at night, to see to walk down the barn, and the wind sometimes would blow that lantern out. We would get some awful wind blows up there on Fuller Hill, you know, today. And so, and another thing was sometimes interesting is the house on the Fred Cardle place. Dad later on sold it to his girl that he brought up out in Montpelier. And they cut it down by hand in sections and took two horse hitch-ups on sleds in the winter and put that house on in sections and hauled it to Montpelier. And that house is today set up on Sunset Avenue up in Montpelier. They tell me, I haven't seen it for a while, but they tell me that they built onto it, so it's bigger than it was then. So I'm going to go over someday and look at it and let the people there know that I knew the history of that house being. But imagine hand saws and crosscut saws and that kind of work, taking the house down and putting it in section, loading it on the double sleds, and two teams go from Warren to Montpelier, about up to far as far as 27 miles at least, and haul that to Montpelier and place it out there.
Tell me a little bit, because I think it is hard for people to understand today, but you worked on the farm and you did all the chores and more.
Yeah.
And at 21, you know, you didn't have any money set aside, and you left to earn a living.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that,
well,
because I think that's interesting.
Dad didn't pay any wages, and so if we wanted to buy something, why go and ask for money? And so, but I used to earn a little spending money playing my violin for dances. I used to play for a lot of dances, kitchen junket they call it in the wintertime, and I had to dance it in the house, and so that's the way I earned a little spending money. And it's kind of interesting to think back then. We'd go to the farm on a Friday night, and they had a piano and organ, and this lady, Mrs. Bashaw, used to go with me. And we'd play from 9 till 1 o'clock, and we got $1.50 apiece. But they usually had such a good time that they'd pass a hat around and near 1 o'clock, and people would throw a dime and a nickel in, and they'd dump what they got on top of the piano or organ and ask it to play another hour. So we quite often played till 2, but it was occasionally that we played till 3 o'clock. And one night in particular, I remember, we was out in Wakefield Common. And we played till 3 o'clock that night, and it was just a little below zero when we got through at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I had to drive my horse 12 miles in a sleigh back to get home. And when I got home, that black horse was just as white as a white horse from his breath, as fresh going on his hair. And when he got in the barn, he was a white horse. And I remember I got $2.75 that night. Each one of us got $2.75. But we played from 9 o'clock till 3. But they stopped at 11:30 and had sandwiches and lunch. And, So that was the way. And so I didn't have any money. And when my, the story of my uncle named me and gave my father a sheep, and the proceeds would be put in the Northfield Savings Bank and for me. And so I'd been probably about a year old when he started my bank account from the sheep up in Northfield. That was the only bank they had, was right there in Northfield. And after, I don't remember what many years it was before I left home, it, Dad stopped having sheep because the dogs and bears got to chasing them. And so he cut out having them. But that bank account stayed there, drawing interest until I was 21. And when I, a week after I was 21, my dad took me to Roxbury, bought my ticket to go to Lynn, Massachusetts. And he said, if you don't find a job, you write to him and I'll give you, send you some money to come home on. Well, I never sent back. But I didn't have any money, only a little I'd saved up from playing the violin. But the funny part is, and I've got a circular I'll show you from the Northfield Savings Bank. They wrote quite a piece and sent it out with the, maybe you've seen it, about my being a long time partner, I guess, or whatever you want, depositor. So I had to work, when I got after Ben, I got a job with the Lynn Gas Electric Company, and I had to walk nearly 5 miles, and where else I could ride some part way on the streetcar.
So you didn't know about this bank account?
Oh yes, I knew it was there, and when I was 21, Dad gave it to me, when he took me to Roxbury to give him a train and give me that, but I hadn't done anything with it, and so I wish I had kept that bank book. So after I'd been down to Lynn there for about a year, I wanted to buy a car, so I wouldn't have to travel. So I rode up to sent the bank book up to Northfield and told them I wanted to discontinue. And so they sent the bank book back and so told me how much interest. And they sent me a check with it for $228 and some odd cents. And I bought my first car, a second-hand car, which has been used for demonstrating, for $225, a Star car, touring car. And
now tell me a little bit about your father and the veterinary business and the fact about you learning how to float horses. And I think I remember you telling that your father taught you, but never gave you a lot of praise, but just said you've done a good job.
As I've told people over the years since I've been doing it, they've asked me how long I've been doing it, and I tell them I've been from 17 on. I was 17 before my dad told me I did a good job. I'd done a lot of horses for him, colts. He showed us boys all how to do it. And every time when I got through, he'd check them and he'd say, well, you're improving, but your angle isn't quite right. You're running it too flat or something. But this particular time, there again, the place the mill people used to bring their...
Let me interrupt for just a second. Use the word that my dad taught me how to float teeth, because I don't think anybody will know what you're talking about.
Well, floating at horse's teeth is they wear, they're slanted, and the upper ones are wider than the under ones, and they, when their mouth is closed, there's an overhang on their upper molars, on the more like eaves on a house. And they get thin and chipped and break off and irritate the horse's cheek, causes a canker sore, and they don't chew good. So there's a little float, is a thing on a little thing on a hand, long handle, and a little file blade made special for the teeth. And you put it into their mouth and you file those sharp corners off, straighten them and make them all the same length. And then that they don't get sore and it won't bother them about chewing or dropping out hay or grain. And so that's what you had to do. And the reason I said 17, Arthur Praed at that time owned the mills there in Warren, And they used to bring their draft horses up to my dad to have them clipped to get their winter coat off, so they'd haul in lumber over the mountain. And after we got those horses clipped that day, we'd clipped four of them, big draft horses. Arthur said to Dad, "I want their teeth fixed." So Dad got his float and stuff, and he did one. And when he got around to the other one, he said, "You mind if my boy does one?" And he said, "No." So I took the float and did that horse, being very nervous with Dad standing there and doing somebody else's horse. When I got through, he checked the horse and he said, "Well," he said, "you've done a good job." That's the first time he ever told me I did a good job. And I remember I was 17. So I tell people I've been doing it off and on since I was 17.
That's a great story. one thing you told me before was the story of Pearlie's accident. And I think it's an incredible story because of just the severity of the accident that he lived through it. And I wondered if you'd tell me that story again.
Well, I don't know just how old he was. He was a boy my folks brought up. And he was up working for my Uncle Amsey. He lived up the next farm above, because, well, Dad owned in between. And he shouldn't have been doing it, but my uncle was the type that left things kind of loose and that like. And he had him oiling this machine when it was running. And he reached over the belt, and it caught his clothes, and stripped his clothes all practically off, except the shirt band around his neck and that leg. And it caught him and rolled him, and he in that went over the pulley, and it tore his testicles out. And so they had got hold of him. He, of course, bleeding quite a lot. And he stood up in a one-horse buggy and rode three-quarters of a mile down to my mother's. And I don't know how he ever stood it. And she was quite a nurse anyway. And she bound him up that like, and they took him to Roxbury, and he boarded the train and went to Burlington Hospital, where they sewed him up and fixed him up, and he lived through it. And that is unbelievable, but it's the God's honest truth. And he lived to, I don't know that old, but he was up in his 70s when he passed away. But that was quite a thing for a man to have to go through.
Now, you told me a story once about Dwight Palmer, milking a cow.
Oh, yeah, this was a... Well, I pulled this story on Dwight. He was manager of our creamery down here, a milk plant. And at that time, I was one of the directors, and matter of fact, at that time, Dwight was retiring. They was giving him a big party down to East Bethel, and I was at that time I was president of the White River Valley Dairies, and so they wanted to have the meeting kind of a little interesting. So they asked me to kind of loosen it up with a few stories. Dick Applin from Boston was here, and Hood Company men was here, and so I told a few stories about Dwight Palmer when he lived at home as a hard-working boy. And of course they milked by hand those days. And the old cow got afraid to kick her foot up and got in the pail. And so he had about half a pail of milk. And he got her foot out of the pail and took it around, and he went around in front and let the cow drink it. His dad come along and said, "What are you doing?" Well, he says, "The old cow put her foot in the pail of milk." So he said, "I'm going to run it through the second time to purify it," he says. So Dwight shook his head at me.
One of the things that you told me before was about building the barn, and how I think it was Walter Hubbard came and lived with you. And
Walter Hubbard from South Royalton was a builder, and he came up and he was in charge of the whole thing. So they got their lumber out during the winter and had it sawed, and then spring come, 1st of May, they started framing those timbers. And back then he made it his home. Well, sometimes he might go to Council Run, but not very often. And he got $15 a week in his board and room. He was the boss carpenter. The other carpenters was framing the thing and got $1.50 a day in their dinners. And that was back in 1913. Something different in wages then and now. And so that barn was built in 1913. And then the 4th of July, they had to raise it. All the neighbors come and put the timber together on the 4th of July. And then, of course, that beautiful wall is standing up by the day my dad laid from the 1st of May, had it ready for the 4th of July. Butman Walls, they called it, under that barn, and that wall is still there today, just as perfect as it ever was.
Tell me a little bit about the barn raising and your mother's job. I mean, everybody did.
Well, they planted. My mother had some help, and they set up tables on the piazza. And my mother made 26 pies for that raisin day dinner. And all the neighbors come and helped out. Of course, a lot of them come to see it go up and stayed there and also had dinner. But they put it. But the last part, way up in the Pearline Place, Nanlake, was finished up on the 5th of July, because there was only a few men could come and help. It could climb so high and walk an 8x8 timber so high up in that barn, because the further end of that barn, the roof to the peak was 50 feet to the ground. But the whole frame, I wish they could take, I had pictures of things like that. But all those 8x8 timbers were put together from the ground, and they were pulled up with rope, people standing on 8x8 timbers in the air, pulling the timber up to its place, and people pushing with pike poles to get it up in place. And that was quite a task, and walking 8x8 timber up there 40 feet in the air and walk around if he was on the floor. And my brother was lower and was one of the fellows that could do that kind of work with. And there were 4 or 5 other men that came back and finished the raising on the 5th of July, but the big raising was July 4th.
After they finished, they had a big dinner. Was there fiddling and all that?
No, we stopped during the 4th of July, during the raising day, noontime. Everybody went on the piazza and had dinner, and then they went right to work after dinner. And then the next day, there was a few people that stayed, got their dinner and that, like, but there was no celebration or anything. It was just a work of job to do.
How has the life in Warren changed from when you were a boy to now?
Well, it's all together. I haven't been back very much. I don't know, hardly know anybody left in Warren except Rupert Blair and a few of those. But of course, it's all changed because all the dairy farmers are gone out of business, and everything's keen. Of course, Rupert Blair's son raises deer, but they don't keep any, and a few beef cattle. But all those, Fred Elliott had a big farm up to East Warren, Pearl Dentals, and all those, Ed Heath and Clarence Strong, and all those people out through there on the North Road had small farms of 18 or 20 cows. Yeah, no more farms there. I don't know what they really, there's only one, I think one little store, Roy Long, used to be Roy Long's store. I don't know now who does have that store. But back when I was growing up there was the other stores, like I mentioned earlier. And of course, I don't know if I ever told you about this kind of a fun time on a Saturday night about the horse backing Arthur Mobus down the stone steps into the basement of George Bragg's store and tipping over a barrel of pickles and ran out and hit the stones with the wheels and left Arthur's girlfriend, Robson girl, sitting in the buggy and got away from him, and the buggy was sitting there and And so that was quite an exciting time.
How did your...
Just realize I'm hearing this clock in here. I just noticed it for the first time. Is it okay if I stop that?
Oh, yeah, sure.
I've done it before. Couldn't tell where it was coming from there. Start that up later. Okay.
One of the other things you told me before was about how close the Mad River and the White River rise together.
Oh, well, out in Granville Woods, pretty near out through the woods to the beginning of Granville Gulf. On the east side of the mountain up there, there are two springs. I was young, went to Pelham by deer hunting. But they're quite close together. I'm probably, maybe they're 25 or 30 foot apart, I'm guessing that. And one of those springs is the start of Mad River. And the other one is the start of White River, Range of White River. One of them, this one on the south comes down and starts the stream. You go down through Granville Gulf. And the other one goes out through to Warren and made Mad River, and you just can't imagine that little spring accumulated enough other water along the way to get so that those mills could operate on water power and saw logs. So that's quite a interesting thing.
Tell me a little bit more about how your father came.
Hi.
A little bit about was how your father, you know, started to become a vet and got involved in training horses. And really, I mean, from hearing everybody talk, he was a terrific.
Well, he was. And what little I know I got from him, I credit him because I wish I knew half of what he did. But he was a natural. His father and they knew how to work horses, but he was right in and born in him. When he was 14 years old, he bought his first horse, a 3-year-old stallion, just Halterbrook, and he trained him that leg. But what he used to do to be a veterinary was when he was a young kid, 12, 13, long in there, the neighbors used to have animals would be sick. And they'd have a veterinary come, and if it was anywhere near, he used to ask your dad, he wanted to go and see how the animal acted. He was interested to want to be a vet, I guess. And so he'd go and see how the animal acted when it was sick. And if it died, he asked the people if he could come back and cut it open and see what the problem was. And so that's what he did. And then he read books, veterinary books, and that, like, he never went to school on it, but he always, what he got from books and experience of seeing them things and that, he started in doing it on his own, little, and neighbors would get so they'd call him. And from that, he, when he later on was a wonderful veterinarian, of course, he did things the old-fashioned way. They didn't have needles to give them shots with and that, like. And everything that you'd for medicine was had to put into them and drench it, put it in a long neck bottle and pour it down them. But that's the way he got to be a veterinarian. He was, for years on the farm, we brothers started in the morning, we didn't know whether to have him all day or not. Phone would ring, somebody had a sick horse, sick cow, and he'd leave and go, and he'd stay with it till it was better. And he did that for years and years. And he was really wonderful, and he done all kinds of operations on them and everything else.
Could you say for me, because you're talking about him, but we don't know that he...
Actually, can I get you a glass of water or something? Your voice is starting to get real raspy
here. Yeah,
getting tired?
No.
We don't have too much longer to go.
Don't bother me. I've been told good many times I talk to Mike, but I tell him I have a reason. My mother, my mother's a woman, so that's why.
There you go.
Long as you need strong stuff, I won't change my voice.
That'd really clear your voice right now. Talking like this. Here's
If you could just start off and say, my father was interested in becoming a vet from, you know, when he was a young boy.
Well, he was, I don't know yet how old he was, but somewhere around 12, 13, when he used to go to the neighbors and see how the animal acted, and from that.
But what I want you to do is say, my father, so we know, see, we came into this with you saying he.
Oh, yeah.
I want to identify
that. Oh, yeah. Well, my father made himself a veterinary from his own experiences and reading books and practicing. And so until the time, a few years before he passed away, he still kept up the veterinary business. And he passed, he was 90 years and 6 months when he passed away, but at the time, 2 years before that, he was out doing veterinary work and doctoring horses and stuff like he always did. And
tell me about some of the kinds of cures, or because I've heard a lot about him. I wondered if you could give a couple of examples.
Well, he was a great man for horses, and he was a breeder. He kept stallions and done a lot of breeding, and traveled around with his stallion to breed mares, and also he was a wonderful trainer. And so we used to have a lot of colts there the year round. They belonged to somebody else, train them to drive, single and double. We didn't train them to ride because we didn't do any riding in those days. It was all, you drove them. And so we had a lot of them. He used to travel all around different places with his stallion and do breeding. And also, he used to, what is today, people think I'm telling, stretching a little bit back in 1978, long in there, he used to do artificial insemination. And people, a lot of people today don't believe an ordinary man like him could do it, but he did. And he got to have a horse, it was half Morgan, that he sent away and got the semen for it, and that was one of his stallions that he used. And so he was quite a man to do it on the cat. And of course, he done all of his own training to be a blacksmith from having so many horses. He used to have around 15 to 27 or 8 horses and colts, all ages. And so he taught himself to do corrective shoeing and take care of the animal's feet and that like. And so there wasn't anything around the animal that he couldn't do. And he was considered one of the greatest men back then in the valley for horsemen. And he's also, a number of years, he was a judge, one of the judges at Northfield Mad River Dog River Fair. And he used to be over there judging horses and so on. And so he had quite a lot of experience.
Now, you also told me that I think your mother used to go throughout the neighborhood, and was she called a nurse or?
Well, domestic nurse or something. She used to go and take care of sick people. And, you know, if they needed help and somebody, she had the ability to do that kind of work. And if any of us kids got hurt or anything, she could. We got a cut or something, she'd sew it up and bandage it up and take care of it. And so she worked pretty hard at doing things like that. And one other thing my father did on his training was he had a stallion, Morgan stallion. He used to drive to town and take his cream to the creamery, and I'd drive him with just a whip out over his ear, no bridle or reins on him. And now you've got to train a horse so you can drive him with just a whip out over the ears to guide him and have him stop. And he did that. and also his Hamiltonian stand, which I have a picture of. He trained him to, you know, take him to fair and different places. He told him lay down, he'd lay down. He told him roll over, he'd roll over, and he had him set up there like a dog. And when he's setting up, asked him to say his prayer, and he'd put his nose down to his knees and groan. He took him out and told him lay down, and says you're dead. He'd lay down and roll right out flat. And he had a Northfield one time, he had him, showed him out in front of the barn, and have 9 or 10 men come and feel of him and check his pulse and done everything else. He lay there just as if he was dead until Dad snapped his finger and then he got on his feet. And so a man can do something, cat knows how to. And that's where I got my education and working around the horses, training them. I've trained, I don't know, I've got an album here full of horses that I've owned over the years and trained for other people to drive and that like. So it's kind of in my blood.
I wanted to go back to the dances, because it sounds like one of the things that happened for enjoyment in Warren was music, and I just wanted you to tell me a little bit more about the kind of music. And
well, back in Warren, town of Warren, of course, didn't have any theater or any movies or anything. People wanted to see a movie, they had to go to Curtin Montpelier. So in the wintertime, back in those days, the farmers and neighbors used to neighbor with each other and go and call on each other and do that kind of stuff. But in the wintertime, when I was a young boy, they used to, about once a week on Friday night, have what they call a kitchen junket in somebody's farmhouse. They'd move all the furniture out, and Mrs. Bashaw and I would go and play for that dance, and that was their entertainment, and they enjoyed it. And I learned to play the violin myself. I never took any lessons. My father used to play a violin, but he didn't know one note from another. But I took some lessons on an organ, so I knew how to read music. And then my brother had a few lessons on the violin, and I was about 4 years older. I found I could do what he could do. So to learn how to play the violin, I sat in front of the organ and put the head of the violin on A and held it down. As long as you held it down there to play that A chord and pump it, and I found out where A was on the violin, and I found from that where I put my first finger on A was B, and I taught myself to read music so I could play for dances and that like and have music to go by. And so I taught myself to play. And then we used to play about once a week in the wintertime, but they out of their entertainment. It was kitchen junkets. And then in May, the odd time, the town of Warren used to have a May ball, big dance in the town hall. And I played in there many times. And Georgie Patterson, which he and his brother had a farm up in where the sugar bush is. Now they tell me that barn or house had been made over in the Italian restaurant. But Georgie used to be one of the fellows who played the trumpet, and we used to have an archer, and I used to play in the town hall there in Warren. And so that was quite interesting, and that's the way I picked up my little spending money.
And I think you also told me about Christmas. The sort of the town celebrated Christmas rather than...
Well, they always used to have at Christmas time in the church, they had a big Christmas tree inside the church. And they always used to have a program, and then people would bring a lot of, for the kids, and then like presents and put them on the tree, and then we'd go in that night down to the church. And the minister would be there and have a little sermon, and then they'd pass out all the gifts for the little kids around. But I never had a Christmas tree when I was at home. We never had a tree at home. We got a few presents. Some of them was a hand-down. Mine was from brothers that had outgrown. But that's the way we had Christmas. They didn't go out like they do today. And I remember my uncle had named me. Gave me 1 year a little sled. It was the first real sled I had. And I'm telling you, I felt pretty big with that little sled that my uncle gave me for because he named me. He's the one who gave him the bank account. And so...
Yeah, now, as a kid, did you ever ride a jack jumper or...
Yes, we used to. We had the travel sleds. There'd be five or six boys, kids get on to ride, and then we made our own jumper out of a barrel stave, wooden barrel stave, and nail a piece of 2x4 on it, and then a little flat seat on top of that, and we would take that and go up in the field and go down over across the crust, and over the field was sitting on that jumper. Sometimes you did jump and you fell off, and but that's the way we used to get our own entertainment. And we used to, when I went to school, they rolled the roads with the snow rollers, and outside the track, by the track where the snow would be smooth and that like. So when I went to school in town of Warren, at noontime, Gardner Hayes had a set of Travis sleds, and there's five of us boys would go up to what they called Thayer's Turn. It's on the road to my father's house. And we could have time for one slide during the noontime. We'd get on there and we'd go down through and pass right down through Warren Village, clear down beyond the lumber mills in one slide. And we used to go pretty fast. But this time in particular, in January, it had a thaw on and then it froze up. And it was pretty slippery. We went up there and we didn't make a turn down but yard long. We went through a barbed wire fence and ended up in the blackberry patch. And got scratched up a little, but we lived through it. and then, of course, I done something that one time up back of Ed Cardle's. I used to drive a horse to go to school with, and it was a mile and a quarter to walk. And up back of his barn, and there was no one. He used to come down through by the town hall, and he had a hay rack. It went on the summertime to hand loose hay set up on some blocks there, but the town hall where they had the kitchen built on back. It was a little jog in it and set up on blocks. So some kid wanted to ride on the Travis sled, and so I took his little sled, which is no way of steering it, lay on your belly and hunch around, and I wasn't used to it, and I came down through pretty fast, and I didn't, I went, the sled went under that hay rack, but I didn't, and I hit my head and knocked me out for a few minutes, and I got back in school, my neck swelled up, so the teacher sent me home because I couldn't turn my head, and I had a egg on the front of my head for a few days, and so I didn't try that anymore. That was a little excitement.
Oh, gosh. Well, I think, do we have to worry about the clock ticking in the earlier stuff?
I don't think so.
It was subtle. I mean, I didn't notice it at first for a while.
Okay, well, I think we got what we wanted, unless there's anything else.
Well, I can't think of anything. Of course, I've got several tapes that you've made up of different things about.
Yeah, and about. I was just really trying to focus
on
those particular things, but you did very well. Thank you.
And of course, when I was a kid, 12, 14 years old, I was driving four horses on a snow roller.
Oh, I didn't realize you'd driven a... Well, tell me a little bit about driving a snow roller.
Well, the town had a big roller that took out the main roads, and then the hill roads, the farmers were hired to roll them. They all had their land rollers and smaller rollers, and Dad, we kept the road open from Dad's farm down to Warren Village. And it would blow sometimes to hard and get drifts, and then Dad and my brother would have to go ahead of the horses when they come to a drift and break a crust so the horses could walk through it. And I was younger, I couldn't shovel so much, so I used to have to set up on the seat of the roller, and we always had the colt hitch to break the colt, have him hitched on the pole. And so when they got the crust broke, they'd come and jump on the back of the roller and we'd go on. And so I've sat on that roller for over 3 hours at a time, hanging on to the reins of four horses when it's down around zero, and come home and put my horses in and stand on a Sam Daniels furnace. And when I saw him get thawed out, I'd shiver. I'd shake, but That's what I had to do because I couldn't shovel so well as my brother and dad. So my job was set up there. And of course, we were taught how to drive horses anyway. And so I drove horses when I was 13, 14 years old. And then springtime, another thing my dad invented, which was great, some roads, when springtime come, by the time spring come, your road was way up in the air. He was riding as high as the top of the fence post, side the fence. And when they gun the thaw out, of course, if they drove a team, everything was horses went down and punched holes in it. Then to freeze up during the night, and a lot of times it's dangerous to try to drive out again, because a hard might step in the hole, and a few of them used to break their legs. So some of the roads, they could leave the road and go out in the field when they were going to break up. But that road was such a woods and stuff on the side, he couldn't. So he had a blade, a metal blade, he fastened to a one-horse sled. And when it started softening up, that blade would take about 2 to 3 inches of the top of the snow. It's just on a slant and push it right off to one side. So I used to take a pair of horses, and sometimes I went from the home down to Warrenville and back twice during the day, scraping the top of that off so to keep it so the horses wouldn't get injured and have a hole to step in. So that was my job.
Well, I really want to thank you, because I think that's just the kind of thing that we've needed.
Yeah, well.
And I guess Miles will tell us.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just going to do this thing where we just sit quietly for a minute.
Yeah.
Just so we don't not want to say anything here. This is Floyd Fuller Rumchow. I think the heat just came on. Shouldn't have. Something just came on. Well, maybe it's the water heater or something.
Maybe the water heater.
Yeah, well, let's just get what we can here. Okay, this is take two of Flight Fuller Room Tone. That's the end of the Flight Fuller Room Tone. Okie dokes.
Well, I hope we didn't tax you too
much. No. I want to show you that article. You probably haven't seen it. It's an off the bank, but tell it for me.
I think there might be somebody out in your garage there. Sounds like it. You expecting anybody?
No, maybe the tenant.
Oh, maybe that's it. Do we have to rush right out, or can I play with this machine for a moment?
I'll play with it. We have a 1 o'clock.
Rush.
Okay.